this series, Worship New Testament Concept. There's actually a couple more lessons in it, so if you want to pick them up, then you'll have to be back on Sunday evenings. We'll finish out our series on Sunday evenings, Lord willing. I have enjoyed the time in here with you, and I appreciate the teachers who gave up their time so that we could all be together for this study. And we have several teachers who lined up. You'll look at your bulletin, you'll see we've got about five classes, I think, that'll start up in different places. So be prepared for those classes to start next Sunday, Lord willing. In our first lesson, or our first place that we went, okay, we can turn the high frequency squeal down now. Okay. In the first few lessons that we had, we went to John chapter 4, and we saw that Jesus put emphasis on a life of worship rather than a place of worship. And we have been in the process of seeing that the New Testament definition of worship and idea of worship is as broad as the Christian life itself is. We've talked some about what I believe the level of motivation that that provides for us. And I believe it provides a motivation that nothing else can provide. And it gives us, if we take this seriously, a deep desire to clean our life up, because who wants to offer to God a sacrifice that's blemished deliberately? And so we don't just clean up a part of our life while we're here and then we leave here and we have another life and another identity. But we're the same wherever we are, because we're worshiping God in everything that we do. The second lesson we looked at, or the second basic fundamental that we looked at, actually about three lessons, we looked at some worship terminology and saw that worship words that were very narrowly used in Greek society as worship words, and words that had been brought over from the Old Testament in the Old Testament sacrificial system, that when those words came into use in the New Testament, in the New Testament writers, that they broadened those words out so much so that in the case of a couple of them, they're translated as godliness and service. And so consequently, and again, I've deliberately avoided trying to make you self-conscious about terminology. But whenever we say we're going to a worship service, that's redundant. That's saying the same thing twice. Now you have to think about everything we've said. So we're either going to a worship or a service. Because it's the same word. Now, again, I'm not trying to make you self-conscious so that the next time that you guys are up here praying and you say something about a worship service and that you catch it and you start trying to correct it, just let it go, okay? It's fine. I'm not trying to make you self-conscious. But I am trying to plant in each one of us a very deep appreciation for the fact that everything that we do, whatever you do in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord. And you offer it to the Lord. And you offer it to the Lord for His glory and for His honor. And consequently, I don't have any money that's mine. And I'm tell you something. That takes a change in attitude. I don't have anything that's mine. It's not, none of it is mine. It's all God's. My children are God's. He gave them to me. It's totally by His grace that I have been able to rear, my wife and I, four children. Our grandchildren are not mine. My money in the bank is not mine. My time is not mine. My body is not mine. And we've got a whole society that's doing some horrific things based on the premise that a woman's body is her own and she can do whatever she wants to with it. And there are millions of little babies that are being killed based on that premise, and that premise is a lie. This world's upside down. And when you start talking this way, then you look like you're the one upside down because you're certainly in the minority. And so you have to make up your mind, who is it most important to please? You want to get along with your people at work? You want to get along with God? And then in a series, the next group of lessons, we discuss why we have such a limited concept of worship. How is it that we, who are so smart and so enlightened and so knowledgeable, how is it that we could possibly have a limited view of something as basic and fundamental, as essential as worship? How could we possibly? That's a hard thought to entertain, isn't it? I mean, after all, my preacher knew what he was talking about, and I trust him. And my mom and my dad and my grandma, they knew scriptures better than anybody I know. And so did my grandma's grandma and my grandma's grandma's grandma. And we could just keep on going. And that's the same reasoning that everybody, every religious person in the world uses. But we're people who go back to the Bible. We're people who go back and open our hearts and our minds and our lives and see what the Bible has to say. And we start making changes when we see that we don't have a complete understanding of some things. And surely we're not in a position where we think we perfectly understand everything, that we've restored everything that God wants restored, and all we have to do is just sit here and hold our own. Surely we wouldn't have a view like that, would we? Some of our concepts are more based in Judaism than they are Christianity. And we're certainly among those who talk about the old law has been done away, don't we? This brings lots of questions to our minds. And I've been telling you all along that we were going to address them, and so now the time has come, and I'm going to try to set the stage to address specifically those problems about the assembly. And lots of questions come up now, because we've made some really strong arguments that are part and parcel of the way we think based on the fact that this is worship. And we leave our sign that so many churches had that was so neat, we thought. Enter to worship, leave to serve. And I find that interesting in light of what we've been talking about, don't you? So, if what we do in this assembly, in this building, is not exclusively worship, then why do we need to assemble? I mean, this really calls into question something that very basic fundamentals. What's the purpose of this assembly? Somebody says, I can just take my Bible and go out on... I don't know. Okay. We might have to change this one out. I don't know. I can just take my Bible and go out on the lake somewhere and get away from everything and everybody where it's really quiet and it's really private, and I can look at God's nature and the beautiful lake and mountains, and I can get closer to God there in that setting than I can anywhere else. And so that's how I choose to do my worship. I choose to do my worshiping privately. And I've got a relationship with God because of that. And so Jesus, yes. The church, no. How do I answer this man? Well, the first thing I'm going to tell him is that there's some validity to what he says. Quiet periods of meditation, when you're in the middle of nature, are probably more conducive on concentrating on God. They really are. I mean, who of us have not experienced that? We've almost been in some setting that's just so, we're awestruck by God's power and God's majesty. It's such a being that could create something like this. Have we not all experienced that? And there's just something about it, we just want to sit down and talk to that God and tell him how much we appreciate this beauty that he created for us. And how wonderful and how powerful he is. And so I'm going to agree with him that the lonely creek bank is more conducive to that than being in a noisy assembly somewhere. Jesus often went off alone to pray, didn't he? He kept looking for a private place to pray. It was hard for him to find a place, because the crowds would find out where he was and they kept coming, but he kept needing a place. And Gethsemane was a special place for him, wasn't it? Why? Because he could go out there in the lonely morning hours and he could be by himself and talk to God. And he needed that. He obviously, desperately needed that time with his Father. Was there something that Jesus could accomplish in Gethsemane that he couldn't accomplish in the synagogue? Yeah, there was. And there is something that we can accomplish out in the privacy of nature and the beauty of nature. Don't you often have some trouble concentrating in our assembly? I mean, this is as quiet as it gets right here, right at this moment, right here. Don't you often have some trouble concentrating in the assembly for lots of different reasons? Maybe the person who's in front of you is doing something that distracts you, or that means you need to sit closer to the front, by the way. Or maybe a baby's crying, or maybe a baby's really cute, and you know, and it takes. Don't you find it difficult to focus in the assembly? And the more folks there are, the more difficult it is to focus, because there's so many distractions going on around us. But let me hasten to add that the man who goes off to the creek bank rather than assembling with God's people is wrong. And he's living in violation of some clear New Testament teaching. Because God, just as he designed Gethsemane and the mountains and the creeks to talk about him and to bring us close to him, so he designed the assembly for a very specific purpose also. And he designed the assembly to accomplish something that you can't accomplish on the creek bank. Just like there are some things that can be accomplished on the creek bank that can't be accomplished in the assembly, there are some things that God designed to be accomplished in this assembly that you can't do on the creek bank. And folks, they're just as important. And we really tend to get focused on those things that really appeal to me personally and individually. But when he called us out of darkness, he called us into a community. And he called us into a family. And in a family, we have family responsibilities. And there are things that are designed to be accomplished for the family in this assembly that if you just deliberately miss this assembly, then you're deliberately choosing to not accomplish what the Lord designed this assembly to accomplish. And let me tell you something. You're going to be weak as a result of it. You're going to really, really be weak. Besides violating what God specifically told us to do, it's going to drain you, because there's something that this assembly, that you do in this assembly, and something that you receive from this assembly that you can't receive anywhere else. And I think if we'll let ourselves stop and just think about it, it's not really that complex. Whenever we sing, have just sung a really beautiful song in this assembly here, has that not done something to you, for you? Doesn't that lift you up? So we're going to talk about those specifics in the next couple of weeks, but we're just going to kind of set it up. But I want to talk about specifically what's wrong with our Creek Boys argument here. This, whenever we go off to the creek bank rather than assembling, then we're making an assumption, and we substitute that time. And we think, well, I can get a lot closer to God out here, you know, among in the middle of nature than I can with all those folks there in that assembly. Then he's assuming that the New Testament teaches that the purpose of the assembly is that each Christian comes and somehow gets himself focused into a special state of mind and a special state of contribution on God. And that's what we come here for, to the point that somehow we can block out all the distractions around us. Now, have we ever prayed any prayers like that? You don't have to say yay or nay yet. I'm just asking you, have we ever prayed prayers like help us to block out this or whatever? All right, well, haven't we? And by the way, there are some things we do need to block out of our mind, okay? I'm not saying that to say such a thing is wrong. If there are some thoughts that are going on in our mind, worldly, we do need to try to block those out, don't we? And there are some things that are transpiring in this assembly that if we'll allow it to, it helps us block those things out of our mind. But he's assuming that the purpose of the assembly is to get honed in on God in some special way of deep reverence. And I challenge you, over the years, I have assembled an entire file on articles on worship and reverence in worship. And I challenge you sometime when you got a little time, you just click on, you can just write in Google whatever reverence in worship and see what pops up. All right? And we in the church write lots of articles on reverence and worship. We used to write a lot more than we do, but we still write lots of articles on it. And I challenge you to find one that does not go back to the Old Testament as its basis. Now you just take it and see if it does. We go back, when we start talking about reverence and worship, then we go back to Old Testament passages for our proof text. All right. My argument with the Creek Bank man is not whether or not he can get himself in a more peaceful state of mind and have an unbroken concentration on God, but my argument with the Creek Bank man is that this is his assumption that this is the purpose of the assembly. Because I don't believe it is the purpose of the assembly. Is the assembly designed for individual, private meditation and concentration? If it is, why the assembly? Why all these people messing me up? Why all these babies making this racket? If that's the purpose of the assembly. I mean, do we need to get the people out that are disruptive to my concentration? Some of us really, really get warped out of the frame about this, don't we? It's because we've got this idea that I'm supposed to be focusing in right here, and if something happens over here to my side that breaks my concentration, then it's just ruined my worship. I don't believe that the New Testament teaches that the assembly is a time for you to sit in your little pew and get honed in on God. I don't mean that we don't think about God. We do not only think about God, but we study about God and we pray to God. And we're going to talk about the specific things that we do while we're here in the next couple of lessons. But I'm going to challenge you that as you go through your Bible and you look at assembly passages, and by the way, there's not a bunch, and you look at assembly passages, that you open your mind up and you ask yourself, what were they doing while they were here? Now, interestingly, and maybe unfortunately, a lot of the assembly passages are addressing abuses of what is taking place in the assemblies. And to be real honest with you, I wish we had more from the other perspective. But that was the purpose of the epistles that were written to address struggles that they were having in the first century church. And so a lot of those assembly passages are addressing problems that they were encountering while they were in their assemblies. When you understand what the New Testament says about the nature and the purpose of the New Testament assembly, it not only becomes important, but it becomes absolutely essential. And I'm really afraid for people who are looking for excuses not to be at the assemblies of God's people. And I mean Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night, Thursday morning, and any other time. I'm really concerned for you when you don't feel any remorse about not being able to be with God's people when they assemble. There is something that we all need and we can only get in the assembly of God's people. And when we identify what that is, that we get only here, then we begin to understand the reason for the assembly. And it becomes something that we want to be a part of. Now, I'm telling you, I think this is the value of this study. And I told you that, at least from my perspective, I think this is a really big piece of our lives that needs to be put in place. Because it gives us direction in our, quote, private life and in our, quote, church life. It gives us direction. And it gives us purpose. And nobody has to be looking over my shoulder to get me to come to church. Nobody has to be looking over my shoulder to get me to live the way that Christ wants me to live whenever I'm not around Christians. Nobody has to catch me doing something wrong to get me to straighten my life out. Not when I'm offering myself as a living sacrifice. And I'm offering myself as a living sacrifice right now. And then whenever I'm out eating with my family in an hour and a half from there, whenever that is. And whenever we're in the car together and whenever everything is happening in my life. What does the New Testament say about the nature and purpose of the New Testament assembly? I'm going to focus for this lesson primarily on one passage because I dare say it's probably the most commonly used passage as a proof text of you need to assemble with saints. And where would that be? Anybody know? Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. Thank you. Several people hit that one. Hebrews is written to people who are in trouble. And as I read through my New Testament and read those epistles, then it really, and the more that I do it, and it's taken lots of years of reading it for me, some of these things to occur to me, I think that there was a lot of variety in the assemblies, by the way, of the different churches. Some of that variety was not good, all right? Some of it was acceptable. But I don't think they were nearly so much get together and have three songs and a prayer and two songs and Lord's Supper and one song and a sermon and invitation song and announcements and closing prayer. I don't think that was that structured at that point. I'm not saying that structure is wrong. But I'm saying I don't think it was nearly so structured. And as I read some of the abuses that the apostles, and particularly Paul, addressed in some of those churches, I'm pretty sure that that's true, that there was some real lack of structure in some of these assemblies. too much so in some places, because he's going to say, let all things be done, what? Decently and in order. There's some of you that are not doing things, you're doing things that are not really decent, and you're certainly not doing them in order, in any kind of an order. And that you've got some people who come into your assembly and they're just really flabbergasted and they don't understand anything that's going on, so they get up and leave. Because all the stuff that's going on doesn't make any sense to them. And so they were pretty loose. They were pretty broad. And he's telling them, okay, you need to tighten this up some. Okay? I think if he were to say to us today, he might say, okay, you need to loosen this up some. All right? Because we're strung pretty tight. And I'll leave that there. These people have been converted from Judaism, but because of the persecution that they were experiencing from their families and friends and people in their communities, and they were in danger of drifting back. And, you know, it wasn't like that they could come into a community and they could visit five churches and they could come to this church and this was all structured and organized and they could evaluate it and say, hey, we like the way that they do things here, or go over here and compare it here. It was the church. And probably it was scattered all over everywhere, meeting in lots of different houses. And there was a significant lack of structure to the whole thing. And it wasn't like we have it here today. By the way, I'm glad that we have it the way that we do today. All right? I like it. I like it, I guess, because it's what I grew up with, basically. But they might not like it, you know, if they came, the first century Christians came here. And they would probably be as amazed in our assembly as we would be to be in their assemblies. And so one of the things that comes out is the way that we structure our assemblies is not necessarily replicates what they did in the first century, all right? I think we do the same things that they did, we just don't do them necessarily the same way, and maybe with the same level of quietness and the same level of structure that they do, that we've come to expect, so much so that people will get a lot more upset if you go 15 minutes overtime than almost anything else that you could think of. Then people get really upset. And it's not that way even in the world. It's pretty unique to us. And pretty unique is no such thing. But it's either unique or it's not. But it's not totally unique to us. But in most places in the world, they don't have this level of structure that we have here. So those of you that have gone to churches in Africa, you know one thing for sure. They don't ever want to say amen. They never want to quit. They just want you to go. And if you preach a sermon that's no more than 35 or 40 minutes, then they'll quietly come up to you and ask you if you got anything else that you could say to them, you know, because they don't want to go home. Right. And people weren't upset about it. You know, that's the neat thing. In fact, the longer you preach, the bigger the crowd grows. You preach very long here and your crowd start leaving. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we've heard so that we do not drift away. So they were in danger of drifting back to where they came from. Chapter 3, let's just get through here and pick up a few verses. Chapter 3, verse 6, he says, Christ is faithful as a son over God's house, and we are his house if we hold to our courage and the hope of which we boast. So as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear his voice, and do not harden your heart as you did in the days of rebellion, and he goes on down, then you'll be saved. But he's warning them. It's always been a tendency. Your fathers had the tendency to do it. You have the tendency to do it, to not hold on to your faith and your courage, and you're going to drift away if you do that. You're going to go back. And so he's writing to people who are really in the process of considering going back because it was just too much of a price to pay. Look at chapter 4, verse 11. Therefore, let us make every effort to enter in that rest so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. He's writing to Christians. Remember that. And he goes back, and this whole section is talking about there were lots of folks who came out of Egypt on the Exodus, and how many of them made it to the Promised Land? Not very many. Why? Because they didn't hold firmly to the hope that they had. Because they didn't retain their faith, their trust in God. Because they got discouraged, because they lost their faith. And so he's encouraging them, don't be like your fathers, but you hold firmly to that hope that you have. Look at chapter 6, verse 11. We want each of you to show this same diligence to the very end in order to make your hope sure. We don't want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit what's been promised. So what's the implication here? That if you lose your faith and you get lazy, you're going to lose that inheritance you've been promised, right? And then chapter 10, we're working our way, it's the theme all the way through the book, chapter 10, and let's pick up with verse 19. Therefore, brothers, since we have this confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way open for us through the curtain, that is, his body, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, number one, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and full faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. That sounds like something you're preparing a sacrifice for, doesn't it? Let us hold, number two, unswervingly to the hope that we profess, because he's faithful who promised. You don't have to worry about him changing his mind at the end and saying, King's X, I was just kidding. And then number three, let us consider how we may stimulate one another or stir one another up. King James says, provoke one another unto love and good works. How do we do that? The next verse, the word let us is not in there. It just keeps on with the sentence. Go back and pick up 24. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but rather let us encourage one another. Where is this encouraging going to take place? When we're meeting together. Why is it so important that we not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing? Because there's so much stuff out there in the world. There's so many things that every one of us are struggling with in our life that we need encouragement. I know lots of people that don't think you do, but you do. And just in case there is some soul out there that doesn't need encouragement, I need encouragement. You got other brothers and sisters that need encouragement. And you weren't called out of darkness just to be an island to yourself. You were called into a family. And family folks have responsibilities to one another. And if the way you view your Christianity is just you and God, then you got a warped view of Christianity. Christianity is a community. And there are lots of other folks involved in this. And God put us together in a family, and he'll write to the Corinthians, and he put you in this family because you have certain talents and abilities that this family needs. And if you're not using those, and what's the purpose of using those? To glorify God? Yes, it does glorify God. But you know how it glorifies God? by you using that to serve one another in love. And if you're not using the talents that God has given you, and if you're not encouraging your brothers and your sisters, then you're just living as if you're an island to yourself, and it doesn't bother you to miss the assembly, and you don't feel like you've lost anything. And we don't have a very accurate view of a New Testament concept of worship. And this assembly is designed for specific things. And he says in verse 23, hold on to this hope that you have. God's faithful, but my brethren ain't. Now, that's not what he said, but that's kind of what he said, didn't he? Isn't that what that said? God's faithful. And so now you take care of your side of this. Let's consider how we can stimulate one another toward love and good deeds. How and where do we do that? Well, one of the primary places we do that is by not failing to assemble, as some are in the habit of doing, but let's encourage one another. Does it encourage you when you look around and there are people that are here that you knew? You know that it takes some real effort for them to be here? Does that encourage you? I'll tell you something. Sometimes we're blessed in this church to have so many young families with children. And sometimes there's a few of us that get a little bit out of sorts when some of these children are a little unruly in the assembly or they're making some racket or whatever. You know what I think about? And I could just look over here and name names right here. I think about the moms and dads who had to get up an hour early in order to get those children dressed. And they might, you know, it's a pretty day and they go outside and this child gets to a certain age and he's whining and griping that he wants to go to the park or he wants to go here or he wants to go there. And they say, no, we're going to church. And it's a struggle all the way here, and yet they're here. And that's an encouragement to me. That's a real encouragement to me. And they're trying to train their children how to sit in the assembly and behave. Now, if I can flip it over, at some point you might have to take them back to the back, okay? All right? Because, you know, you've maybe done all the training that could be done at that particular moment right there, you know. Or maybe there is some other kind of training that needs to be done out there, but whatever, you know. Just use your, you know, God given common sense in this. But hold on. Don't give up. Encourage one another. And by the way, if you're not struggling against sin, then this doesn't mean anything to you. And you know that maybe that's some of our problem. Maybe we've given in to sin too much. And maybe we're not really struggling against sin. And maybe we don't really feel a need for brothers and sisters and the encouragement that comes from the assembly. But I tell you one thing, when life comes crashing in, you know where people look? They look to their brothers and sisters. And we feel a need. And the interesting thing is we always have a need. And maybe we have a need more whenever we think we're standing, take heed lest you fall. Maybe we have more of a need at that time than we do when we realize that we have a need. Maybe we're in more danger whenever we think everything's going great and wonderful and we just kind of push our spiritual life back to the side. And so if you're those that are struggling, hold unswervingly to the hope. Draw near to God with a sincere heart. And then verse 24, come on, everybody, let's get together so that we can encourage one another, love and good works. And by the way, if we encourage one another, love and good works, among the things that we've studied is that's worship. We're encouraging one another to get out here and really worship God. Life has a way of wearing away at our spiritual convictions, and we have a tendency to compromise. In verse 25, look at those who've given up meeting together. Where are they spiritually? You know where they are spiritually. And so he encourages us, don't give up meeting together. This highly individualized concept of coming to individually commune with God and block out everything else is detrimental for the purpose to which we come together. If that's the purpose, then as I said earlier, when we build this new building, we need to really have a radical design. We need to have little cubicles about this wide. Some of us might need one about that wide. But we need them to go up high enough that we can't see anybody else, so that we can only see straight ahead, because we might be distracted by somebody beside us. If that's really our purpose, to get focused, wouldn't that help us get focused in? And then we wouldn't have to worry about all these distractions here. We could make this thing soundproof if we really got, and we could all have a set of headphones so that you could only hear the preacher or you could only hear the song leader. And boy, I mean, hey, we'd be fixed up. We'd be uptown, wouldn't we? And then we could really worship God then. I've been alone all week, and I need you to encourage me, and I need interaction. And I'm not advocating chaos. All things, he'll say in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, all things to be done in decently in order. And if you'll go to 1 Corinthians 14, and I intended to go there this morning, but I talked too long to enable me to get there. But write down 1 Corinthians 14, 26, FF. That's in the context that he's addressing the problems that they're experiencing with tongue speaking. But he says, let everything be done for the encouragement of those in the assembly. Everything's to be done to encourage those who are there. Many of us come to the assembly with only ourselves in mind, and we become indignant at distractions. And we have become self-centered, even in our assemblies. And that's not why he designed assemblies. If he did, why did he even want us to get together if we're to be self-centered? If we're to just block everything else out? You take care of your personal needs for devotional meditation on the creek bank or in your closet or wherever, but that's not the purpose of this assembly. These acts of worship that we're going to look at in the next couple of weeks in the assembly setting are designed to edify and encourage one another. You look at them and see. And when we realize that, we're going to get better at doing them. Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Singing, making melody in your heart. Teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns. Right? This is a one another thing. And these are designed to edify and encourage one another, and you can't get that out on the creek bank. And this visiting that we hear that makes it difficult to get the class started and out in the foyer where the noise level is, I don't know how many decibels. This is family. This is people enjoying being together. It's family getting together, and that's the heart of the assembly. Wouldn't it be a sad thing if it was so sterile that everybody just got up and they were quiet all the way to your car and you didn't talk to anybody? Wouldn't that be a sad thing? Well, I wouldn't want to come to that. Would you? You remember what Jesus said was to be the premier distinguishing mark for his disciples, that you have love one for another. And one of the ways that we show that love is when we get together. We're not just focused on ourselves and our needs, and we don't leave thinking what it did for me. We come here looking for what we can do for our brothers and our sisters while we're here, how we can encourage and build one another up. God provided the assembly for motivation. That's no small deal. Thank you. We'll pick up there, Lord willing, next Sunday night.